Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettmeyer. In the second half of today's show, we're going to be talking with Chuck Lacey from Jericho. He's a local beef farmer. He's got a past as the president of Ben & Jerry's. He's involved in capitalizing agricultural enterprises, all sorts of interesting aspects to comment on with regard to agriculture. And we're going to be talking about barriers to entry for small, medium-scale farmers, people who want to do farming at more than the hobby level, but not the real industrial agriculture level. So it's just closely allied with our conversation with Robin McDermott in the first half of the show. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Carl.
So tell us about your beef operation to begin with.
We'll have three projects. One is I started with a couple of colleagues' beef genetics business, bringing in grass-fed beef genetics, Red Devons, from New Zealand. And we sell semen and fertilized embryos and breeding stock and bulls to people who are producing 100% grass-fed beef. And the reason is, for the last 40 or 50 years, we've been breeding animals to do well in feedlots. And if you take today's beef animals in the United States and stick them on grass and don't give them corn, you don't really get a good product, which is why sometimes people have had uneven eating experiences eating grass-fed beef. So we specialize in those genetics. And then we started a beef business selling the meat produced by our genetics customers to stores around the Northeast. And we're still small, about 550 animals last year, selling to mostly high-end butcher shops in Boston and New York. And we also sell, the brand is called Hardwick Beef, and we're in Healthy Living and City Market and the Lebanon Hanover co-ops here in Vermont.
So how many producers do you have in?
About 20.
20 producers are getting together and selling a total of 550 animals per year.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And does that work out to an average size of 550 divided by 20, about 25 animals?
No,
per
we have some. We have some farmers that are selling. I think our biggest one is probably selling about 80 animals, mm-hmm. and we probably have a couple that are doing 10 or 15. And in no case is it all of anybody's production. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're selling beef year round, so we're kind of working with people to get meat to fill our slots, through the 12 months. Mm-hmm. And also, we encourage people to sell beef locally to their own customers. They can make more selling it direct to customers than they can to us. So
you encourage your producers to sell through some other channel than you?
Yeah, then they know how hard it is for us to sell the rest.
Right. Well, my wife was farming Scottish Highland cattle for a number of years, raising them as beef. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons she got out of it was that it was so hard to sell. And she doesn't like doing the marketing. She likes doing the farming.
Yeah. Well, me too. And then we have about 230 acres of leased pasture in Jericho and Richmond, and produce grass-fed beef myself. We sell most of it locally, but also sell some to Hardwick Beef.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you do breeding on the farm?
Yep.
Okay. Well, looking at the current agricultural situation in Vermont, barriers would you put your finger on to people getting into the small-scale producer category for actually making a living for themselves?
Well, I think first, I just say how inspired I was by the hearing at the State House, mm-hmm. whatever it was, 6 weeks ago, and mm-hmm. This was a hearing that the Senate and Ag and the House Ag committees had for people to just come in and talk about what was on their mind. And I think there must have been 250, 300 people there, and 90 people spoke. And four of them were conventional dairy farmers, talking about the price, legitimately concerned about the price of milk. But all of the rest were, people producing raw milk on a small scale, selling directly to customers, pork producers, beef producers, vegetable producers. And I just felt like there was this army of people of all generations. I mean, people talk about, farmers getting old. I mean, I saw a lot of farmers there in their 20s and 30s and 40s just ready to go. Mm-hmm. And, one of the things that, I just heard over and over again. I mean, 90 people tested. It was 86 people testified who weren't conventional dairy farmers. It was basically telling the state to get off my back, that the regulations are, you're regulating me small. You're keeping me small. or forcing me to go underground because of all these, you know, all these regulations.
We had one person who's been on this show before, Peter Harvey, who was partially responsible for the on-farm slaughter bill last year. Raises pigs on his, like, three pigs a year on his farm, and they're half-owned by some neighbors, and they slaughter them on the farm, and they split them by the half pig. The legislature passed a bill last year making that legal for him to do it. He had no idea that it was illegal before that.
Yeah.
And now the Ag Department is saying this doesn't conform to federal law, so you'll need to change this bill back, legislature.
Yeah.
And he said, if you do change that back, then you're going to make a criminal out of me because I'm going to keep doing this.
You know, that was really, I heard that three or four times at the hearing. Well, I'm going to do it anyway. You know, I mean, this is something so basic as growing an animal on my place and selling some meat to my neighbor. How could something that basic be illegal? You know, afterwards, I was really inspired, and I went back and reread my history on Gandhi's salt march, you know, where he was just saying, you know, this is ridiculous that you can only buy salt from the British government, and let's all go to the coast and make our own darn salt. And I was inspired in that way.
Mm.
And what I heard over and over again at that meeting was things that, you know, I've sort of been aware of over the last few years, is how many of our agriculture regulations are designed to keep people small. And, you know, many of us hear about farms that are doing, they're doing poultry and they're doing pigs and they're doing beef and they're selling a little raw milk and they're doing all this stuff. And why is it that they don't specialize? You know, why is it why are they struggling with, you know, all these different things? And I mean, it's a great business model for people who are selling direct and selling to their neighbors, and they have people that, you know, want to buy all their stuff from one farm and from somebody who may or may not be an expert in everything. But one of the reasons why is that people are limited in what they can do. That Vermont, I think, has, we have this image that, a real farm, you know, is a big dairy farm, and that we don't really expect big, robust farms and other categories that support a family or two, and that, you know, sons and daughters can join and grandchildren can join in, that those are dairy farms, and that there's this, you know, all these other farms are ones that, you know, they're quaint and they're nice and they're, you know, kind of Vermont-y, but, you know, we don't really expect them to, we're not figuring out how to grow them into something substantial. You know, where I grew up, there's a place called the Larison's Turkey Farm. And this was a place that had, it was a restaurant. And you'd go up to the restaurant and there'd be like 1,000 turkeys, you know, off on the side. You'd go in and you'd just go, gobble, 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 gobble. Get all the turkeys, scatter the turkeys. And then you'd go in and go into this roadhouse for a turkey dinner. I don't think I ever ate there, but they sponsored my little league team, and the kids from school, you know, were Larisons, and my mother, they used to sell the carcasses they used after the turkey dinners for 75 cents. So I grew up on turkey sandwiches and turkey soup. But
here in Vermont?
No, this is not in Vermont.
Okay.
But I can't imagine a business like that in Vermont. I mean, I just can't imagine, you know, trying to start a business like that. I mean, in Vermont, you're not allowed to slaughter more than 1,000 birds, without building a facility.
Well, rural Vermont famously had to fight for the right of a restaurant in Mad River Valley to buy chickens from across the road from the neighbor.
Right, and you know, when you look at that, and it's like, how can you not ask the question when you're passing legislation like that? Can you make a living selling 1,000 birds?
Mm.
You know, and if you're good, you can maybe make $6-7 a bird. So basically we're saying to people, okay, you can do chickens and you can slaughter them on your place, but you can only make $6,000 or $7,000 doing it.
Mm.
And that's why people are doing, you know, all these different things.
Mm.
And we do have some flexibility between 1,000 birds and 20,000 birds on the type of facility and inspection and all that people can undergo. After 20,000 birds, the federal laws kick in and you have to have an inspected facility. And our meat inspectors, who I greatly respect, and are, particularly Randy Quinville, who I know the best, who's the guy who runs it, is, you know, really a highly skilled professional, but the ideology of the agricultural department is that we're going to make sure that no one gets sick from a Vermont product, kind of at all costs. At the same time, the choice between buying a bird from a local producer, you have your choices between buying a bird from your local producer, and as Bob and these earlier people talked about, at a, you know, at a reasonably high price, because if someone's only doing 1,000 birds, they got to charge a reasonably high price. They're buying feed at, you know, at high costs and all that stuff. The alternative is to buy meat from out of state at, you know, in these huge confined feeding facilities, you know, and you know, they're just, by design, they're horrific. You know, these huge feedlots which give antibiotics to the animals every day just as a prophylactic, because if you confine animals when they're standing around in their own dung, you know, they're going to get sick. So you have to give them antibiotics. And, you know, the reason you don't see any livers in the supermarkets is because the livers are burned out. In these feedlots. I mean, liver is no longer a food because the livers are no good coming out of feedlots.
Mm. We're talking with Chuck Lacey. He's a farmer in Jericho and works with Red Devon Genetics and marketing local beef through Hardwick Beef. If you'd like to talk to him about these issues of local farming, the number here is 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255.
So you have a meat recall, a beef recall, 148 million pounds, you know, and it's an isolated incident, you know, basically, oops, we'll do better, you know, or...
Have you calculated how many years' production of Hardwick beef would be 148 million pounds?
It would be big, or, you know, peanut butter, you know, 95, you know, according to, I mean, recently in the papers, you know, 95% of food plants are never inspected. Well... I mean, it was basically we're saying, okay, and then, you know, in the last few days, there's been articles or columns about a hog-producing region in Indiana where the pigs are getting these antibiotics. And what happens is when animals get antibiotics routinely, that the bacteria can, you have antibiotic resistant strains of bacteria have the opportunity to evolve because they got plenty of time to practice on these antibiotics. So now there are... you know, there are bacterial infections in this town, Indiana, that are untreatable by antibiotics. Mm. And so we're saying that basically these systems are all okay, but that we don't want someone to slaughter more than 1,000 birds on their place.
Now, are we saying that those systems are okay, or are we saying that these are signs that those systems are broken and they need to be
I think reformed? In Vermont, we're saying that they're okay because we're not prepared to allow Vermont businesses to grow to the point where they can really meet Vermonters' needs in terms of those. And I mean, look at where we are. You know, we're a little state in the Northeast, very mountainous, valleys. You know, we are going to be sort of small and medium scale agriculture. And we have to, you know, we have to figure out ways to allow people to grow. And, you know, the issue is you can slaughter 1,000 birds, you know, without building a facility, but you slaughter one more bird, you have to make a huge investment in terms of a facility, and you can't do that if you're making $6,000 or $7,000 a year on your chickens.
What does a slaughter facility look like that's authorized to slaughter 1,001 birds?
It has two rooms and running water in both, and
special bathroom for the inspector.
No, that's okay. A myth. Okay. You know, but it's a serious investment, mm-hmm. and you know, and there are states that allow people to do more than 1,000 birds because they have the flexibility.
Virginia and allows 10,000, doesn't it?
Yeah, Virginia does. Pennsylvania does, allows more. But, you know, our policy is to take the strictest view. And that is the view you should take in isolation, and you want to maximize food safety, you know, just in Vermont. But if you cut somebody off at that level, they can't grow to become a producer that does 30,000 or 40,000 birds, because you have to jump from 1,000 to... a large facility. And the same is true with raw milk. You know, raw milk, 9 out of the top 10 dairy states in the country allow farmers to sell all the raw milk they want with, you know, various rules in terms of the quality and safety and that kind of thing. Vermont ranks 14th, and we limit them to 50 quarts a day. 50 quarts a day is, you know, how many gallons is that? That's...
It's going to be 12 gallons. 12 gallons.
Okay. Like, how can you make a living selling 12 gallons of milk a day?
You know, and $8 a gallon, it's, you know, a decent amount of change, but still, it's hard
to make
a living.
You know, that's not enough. That's like, you know, like that's health insurance for a month. I mean, you know, in terms of your annual income, it's nothing you can support a family on. You know, it's not a robust family enterprise. Mm-hmm. You know, I want people to be able to make $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 farming.
Here's a circumstance right where I live in East Montpelier. A farmer neighbor of mine, it raises replacement heifers for selling out of state, unfortunately. But the bottom has gone out of the replacement heifer market just because dairy farmers aren't getting anything for their milk these days, and they can't afford to be making these sorts of investments. At the same time, rural Vermont is saying there's a big market for raw milk in the Montpelier area that's not being met. You know, is he going to go over to raw milk? Well, for 50 quarts a day, I don't know.
No, I don't. You know, I don't think he certainly. If he did, it would be a sideline. You know, it would still be. It would sort of fit in this kind of, you know, more than a hobby, but not a living category. Mm-hmm. And he would have to do four or five things also. You know, also with his, you know, with his limitations. Mm-hmm. And simple stuff like, you know, lard. You know, you can take your pigs. Even if you take your pigs to USDA slaughterhouse and bring the fat back, you can't boil it down and sell lard. And if you were able to do that in your kitchen, I mean, my God, I would. And it also, if you do that, you can make an extra $50 a pig.
$50 a pig.
Yes, and wow. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is give consumers. Farmers a choice and give consumers a choice. If people trust the USDA system, if people want USDA inspected beef, if they want pasteurized milk, if they want all these things, they should have the opportunity to buy that stuff. You know, and you know, one of the long-term risks is that people are losing their ability to exercise any knowledge or judgment around food safety for themselves. They just assume if it comes from a supermarket and has a plastic wrap around it, that it's safe, mm-hmm. You know, and people losing the ability to judge, you know, to look a farmer in the eye and make some judgments. I mean, within 20 miles of my house, there are people I would not buy raw milk from, and there are ones that I do, and that's because I'm exercising judgment over the, you know, the cleanliness of the place.
Mm. That's really a presupposition of the free market in economics, is that people have free access to information and they're able to make choices based on what's available. But the regulations are cutting out some of the choices and thereby undermining the free market.
Right. And they're. I mean, if you want to have big, successful, robust family size businesses that are maybe maybe supporting a couple families and a couple children and grandchildren, that kind of thing, you got to let them be middle-sized businesses, mm-hmm. and we're cutting them out. You just plain have to let them grow. Also, one of the things, I mean, I want to be able to slaughter beef on my place, you know, and, you know, sure, we go through the fiction of selling the animals to five different people and we slaughter them and then take them to a meat cutter and all that, but I don't want to have to do that. Mm. One of the things that is bogging down our slaughterhouses is that we're asking them to do meat cutting. Mm. And they're great at slaughtering, but meat cutting is hard for them. You know, why not go to meat cutters who have the experience of dealing directly with consumers? You know, I want to be able to slaughter an animal. You know, they always say, you know, if you want, you know, try to shoot your deer when it's resting. You know, because that's going to be the best meat. And the same is true of an on-farm slaughter. You know, it's a real, it's a way to improve the quality of your product, reduce your costs.
Do you think that there's a need for a different sort of standards for food that's sold in supermarkets, as we had one of the callers asking about getting local food into supermarkets earlier, versus food that's sold directly in the farm or through farmers' markets? The reason I ask is supermarkets, you're just seeing a product on a shelf. You aren't looking a farmer in the eye asking questions.
Yeah. I think I would say yes. You know, I think when you step into a supermarket, you've decided to put your safety in their hands anyway. You know, they've got meat on their counters. They've made a judgment that they think it's safe for you. And you know, if you trust your supermarket to do it, then yeah, I think, you know, I think so. And in terms of raw milk, you know, of those nine top dairy states, California by far is the biggest dairy state. You can sell raw milk in stores.
You can sell raw milk in stores.
Yeah,
in
you
California.
Can in Massachusetts. And in states that allow raw milk sales have a lower incidence of problems with people drinking raw milk than states that don't.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
I got no idea. I got the information from the Vermont Department of Ag, though.
Okay. So if you can sell raw milk in stores, does it have the label of the farm that it was raised on?
Well, I mean, no. In California, there are some very big raw milk dairies that are buying milk from a variety of farms, and they market it as raw milk.
I'll be darned.
I mean, big dairies.
Mm. Okay. Well, we're about out of time. You have any last comments, Chuck Lacey?
No, I just want it to thaw really slowly.
So we don't have flooding. Very good. Chuck Lacey is a regular caller to this show and former president of Ben & Jerry's. He works with Hardwick Beef, marketing local products, Red Devon Genetics, and does a whole lot more around food policy and activism. Chuck, thanks so much for coming in today.
Sure, thanks. Great show. You have a great show.
Thanks. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for today's Equal Time. Tomorrow, I'll be substituting for Travin via CD, as you heard a little bit earlier, recapitulating some broadcasts from January. I think they'll be pretty interesting. Anthony Polino will host on Wednesday and Thursday. I'll be back on next Monday. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host. Thanks to Artie Levine for engineering. Stay tuned for Jack Donovan, and thanks for tuning in.